Okay, so my talk today, first one, is going to be on pump versus off pump cabbage. Oh, clicker? Yeah.
Make sure
it's on. Oh, good. Okay. How do I turn it on?
On the side there.
Oh, yeah. Okay. There you go. On pump and off pump cabbage. Now, as you know, this has been a hotly debated topic for years. It's been beaten up for years. But I want to bring up something I think new to it that may be important for us to understand. And the question is, have I been wrong all these years? Because I have strongly advocated against it. So I'll answer that question at the end of my presentation.
Are you ever wrong? That's my question.
No.
I didn't think so.
No, absolutely not. So let's go to the next slide. It's not working. Oh, there it goes. Okay. So here is, this is killing me. Too many screens. That's not the slide I wanted. There we go. Okay. So the undeniable facts, I'm glad I could be comedic relief today. The undeniable facts are that I have been critical of off-pump cabbage surgery for years, except in very specific, isolated circumstances. Off-pump cabbage has been studied and debated for years. Off-pump cases peaked around 2011 at about 31% of the cases being done off-pump. Today, it is around 11% or actually less. And there is a good reason for that. In selective cases, however, for very specific reasons, as I said, it is a good option. You need to be able to do that sometimes. Eggshell aorta, various other, things like that. Single vessel, single lima to the LAD, and you want to do it as a TCAB. I can understand that. But you still really have to be concerned about the long-term durability of that graft. That is why the patient is there at the end of the day. However, what are the facts, the undeniable facts in this whole argument? Well, along comes this article by the Journal of American College of Cardiology, versus where it was published. Now, this was only about 2 years ago. Long-term outcomes after off-pump versus on-pump coronary artery bypass grafting by experienced surgeons. And that's a very important point. And let me go to this slide. They studied over 20,000 patients, so the N number is enormous. Not only did they match the off-pump versus on-pump or compare them, the off-pump were done by surgeons who typically do off-pump, and the on-pump was done by surgeons who typically only do on-pump. So you have patient matching and you have surgeon matching to what their typical skill set is. And that's a very, very, very important piece. However, at the end of the day, patients tended to be the on-pump patients when they had underlying renal dysfunction, ESRD and dialysis dependent, recent MI, an EF of less than 35%, diabetics, left main disease, three-vessel disease, peripheral vascular disease, and previous stroke. Now, in my view, if that is how you match the... If that is how you match these patients, then at the end of the day, you've taken the sicker of the patients and put them into the group that should have, at the end of the day, worse outcomes. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Does anybody out there disagree with that? Let me know. So, I can stop my talk right here. This is the end of this. This could be the end of my presentation. And if you look at the blue line, which is off pump, versus the orange line, which is on pump, and you look at cumulative event rate, that stroke, MI, renal failure, and need for revascularization after the procedure, revascularization, if you will, you can see clearly by that graph that it is superior. You have less frequency with on pump versus off pump. So let's just drill down on it a little bit and see what's going on here. So from top left going over to the right, myocardial infarction, essentially the same. Stroke rate, essentially the same. Down bottom right, new renal failure requiring dialysis, essentially the same. But the need for repeat revascularization, and what that really means is early graft failure, is clearly, you can see that, you can see daylight between those lines, you can't with the other ones, and that's where the difference really lies. When you do off-pump surgery, not only are you contorting the heart and trying to operate on it from odd angles because you have to keep a perfusion pressure and flow because you don't have the pump supporting the patient, you also are at odd angles, bleeding, non-stability, and you're trying to create the same quality of anastomosis that you would create if it was a completely bloodless, still field where you didn't have to worry about protecting the brain, protecting the kidneys, protecting the other organs. You were flowing, and the heart was protected with cardioplegia. So, in their study, and by the way, this came from a New Jersey mandated registry. New Jersey mandates the registry. So all of this information was required to be put in it. And at the conclusion, off pump was associated with increased incomplete revascularization, repeat revascularization. So keep that in mind. Incomplete revascularization is almost just as bad as early graft failure, and mortality at 10 years compared with the on-pump CABG group, suggesting that on-pump CABG may be the appropriate choice for most patients undergoing surgical revascularization. And, you know, and why, you know, why we see it go from 31% to maybe under 11% to 10.5% today is for that very reason. But there are still some people out there who insist on doing all of their cases off pump, and I frankly just do not understand why. The data, I don't think, is arguable in my view. There's been several studies like this. This isn't the only one. So I can't quite understand it. I put this STS database link up there, and I want to leave it up there for a few minutes, and I'll just quickly talk about it so people can copy it or have an opportunity to see what it says. But it's essentially riskcalc.sts.org/STS web risk calc/calculate. Go to that, and you can probably just go to sts.org and search for it and find it. It's very easy. But we should be doing these. Perfusion should be doing these, certainly. Anesthesia should be doing these. Anytime you're in the OR, it's very easy to do. They even have an app for your phone. So it's simple to do, but it really gives you a window into what the risk this patient has of early of mortality, of renal failure, and of stroke, the three things that are really important to us that we see every day. That's, I think, going to be my goal today, is talk about some of these morbidities that are associated with heart surgery, even when on pump. Because as I said, stroke rate was equal, new renal failure requiring dialysis was equal, MI rate was equal. The only thing that was different was in the early graft failure or incomplete revascularization. That doesn't give me much comfort. I would rather on pump was better in reducing stroke. I would rather on pump was better at reducing renal failure. And can we get there? That's really what the challenge is. So when you look at morbidities associated with CABG, stroke rate is anywhere from 0.5 to 7%, depending on the procedure and depending on a lot of other variables, but it's around that. renal failure 0.6 to 5%. Even a small increase in the serum creatinine level, which is not unusual after pump, is holds a 3 to 4 fold increase in long-term risk of end-stage renal disease. So the question to my colleagues is, how can we make being on CPB better? How can we make the pump better? That's what we should be doing. You know, I remember when we went from screen and disc oxygenators to bubble oxygenators. We thought that was revolutionary. Then to membrane oxygenators, which are really microporous oxygenators, not true membranes. We went to that, but that was in the late 80s. What have we done differently since then? Now we have some, you know, passive biocompatibility. We had, you know, of course, we had the Carmita for a while, which is a biologic biocoating that they put on a lot of tubing, used them for liver transplants and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, for some heparin, you know, so the system wouldn't clot, but that leached out after a period of time. I don't see that very often anymore, but they have the non-biologic smart coating, they call it now. But I think industry has to step it up and start really making a system that reduces the inflammatory processes that occur when you go on pump to a bare minimum. We can't do a whole lot with sternotomy. That's just going to cause inflammation on its own. We used to use aprotinin, but of course aprotinin has been gone. If we could find some additional pharmaceutical agent that could block the inflammatory process, kallikrein inhibiting units that we could find like triazolol or aprotinin had, that would be great. But I think the pump itself, they can do a lot to it to reduce that inflammatory stimulus that occurs. When we perfuse, all we ever really look at, really measure, is the macro circulation. We've talked about this. I've talked about it. But all of the nutrient and waste exchange occurs in the capillary bed. That's where it all has to happen. The macrovasculature is simply to get the blood there and then bring it back so it can be processed again and sent back around. So the microvascular is very important. And we don't measure it clearly, but we measure things that infer. So we look at blood gases, we look at lactate levels, we look at other metabolites to assess how efficiently we are perfusing this patient. But is that enough? So these are two images of the microcirculation using sublingual sidestream dark field imaging. And the one on the left is essentially a normal patient. The one on the right is a patient who is in septic shock. Now, I will tell you that I have done this, and I'm not going to show you in this particular presentation, but I've done this in the operating room with a patient going on bypass and have seen the microcirculation sublingually disappear. Now it came back, but it disappeared right off the beginning. And it was very disconcerting to me. And I think there are some phenomenon that occur and I think hemodilution was a big part of that. So one of the parts, if you will, of the endothelium, which is, I think, poorly understood, though it's common, but poorly understood. You know, it wasn't discovered until 1970. Yeah. I didn't, the glycocalyx.
Wow.
1970. I mean, that's 50 years. We should be a lot farther along than this.
Absolutely.
But when you really think about it in medicine, that's maybe really not that long ago.
No, I mean, 10 years in medicine is like a minute.
Yes. And I don't feel like we as a profession and perfusion profession have really given this much consideration. And I want to talk about some things about it that I think really, really piqued my curiosity. So what is the role of this glycocalyx? Well, it has endothelial function. It's a nitric oxide synthesis, or helps in the synthesis of nitric oxide, I should say. It's shear induced. It controls permeability. So it's a sieving barrier. When you lose your glycocalyx, you're going to have albumin pass through, proteins pass through into the interstitium, and that's going to create edema. It is beneficial in coagulation, inhibits platelet adherence, and it prevents leukocyte adhesion and inflammation. So it does a lot of stuff, but again, we don't really think about it very often. And I'm gonna show you some things that are really interesting. So take a look at this slide. On the top, you have a healthy glycocalyx. And that, if you look down on the right, you see the, down on the right of that picture, you see the size. That measurement, that little line at the bottom is 0.1 microns. 0.1 microns. That's 0.0001 millimeters. That is extremely, extremely small. So it's very, very small. Now, the next picture that you see is the is obviously a damaged glycocalyx. You see where the vascular lumen is. You can clearly see it's damaged. And then you see beneath it is the endothelial cells. And then on the third, that is disorganized. So there's various different things that can occur to the glycocalyx for a variety of reasons. And breakdown of this important barrier can have real, very significant ill effects. So when we look at this slide here, and I got this from a Master of Science nursing student poster presentation, and it talks about what the glycocalyx is. You know, mostly it's a glycoprotein and lipid protein. So that's its basic composition, but it helps, as I said, with regulating nitric oxide, vascular tone, endothelial wall stress, permeability, inflammation, all of these things. And when you have a breakdown, you can get capillary leak syndrome, edema, increased inflammation, platelet aggregation, hypercoagulability, loss of vascular tone. So these are big deals. And if you take a look here, it explains that in sepsis, now I would argue that when we go on pump, we're not septic, but there are phenomena similar to sepsis that you see when you put somebody on cardiopulmonary bypass.
Absolutely.
But there's a degradation and the layer becomes thinner and more sparse, allowing plasma proteins vis-a-vis albumin and fluid to move across the vascular wall, leading to tissue edema. We've all seen those patients. They're swollen up. That edema is coming from a capillary leak. This is part of it. Now, I know they used to have a drug called Zygris. I don't know if you remember Zygris or not.
I remember very well. I was one of the sub-eyes for the study.
Really? Okay. Yes. Yeah. So Zygris would be used to try and inhibit that loss of capillary leakage. It was that's what it was for, to protect against capillary leakage. But if that's correct. So what more do you know about it?
Well, it decreases inflammatory response. But I'll tell you just before one thing. Before Zygris, there's an institution which where I did some of my training that routinely gave a gram of steroids on pump. That was a routine case for them. Mm-hmm. Whether that's right or wrong, but that was the same concept too. So Zygris activated protein C was supposed to help with the inflammatory response.
Right. So, and that was actually, was that at the same time we were using aprotinin? I think it was.
It was around the same time. And I'm going to have one disclosure here, and don't hate me. I'm a big aprotinin fan. And I think we did a disservice to the cardiac community by abandoning it.
I think so too.
Still being used in Germany. We had it for a while after it was banned for compassionate care, and I think it really worked a lot.
Mm-hmm. I think it worked too. I thought it was a great drug. In fact, I remember doing cases, doing type 1 dissections, and we would come off
vats.
Pump, and they would be dry as chip dry.
Transplants, vats, everything.
They just did great with it. I'll tell you what, it was something else. So, the effects of CPB are well known: inflammatory activation, prothrombotic profile. We vary temperatures. Hemodilution, we still use, irrespective of the systemic blood pressure, we still have these things happen. So you can be high pressure, low pressure, mid pressure, doesn't make any difference. There's still ill effects of CPB, no matter what you do. Leads to a reduction also in functional capillaries, and that's very important because, again, all of the nutrient and waste exchange occurs at the capillary level. And when you start getting capillary bridging, you start getting shunting, you start losing capillary density, you have a big problem.
Can I start trouble or not yet?
No, you can start trouble right now.
I can start trouble right now?
Yeah, do it. Let's do it.
Okay, so let me tell you, I agree with you 100%. So what's your thoughts about doing off pump with an assist device on board?
With an assist device, you mean like one of those?
Like, let's start from the balloon pump to all the way to 5-0 Impala to a little ECMO. There's talk, you know, there's some surgeons believe ECMO doesn't cause inflammatory response like the pump. And there's a lot of transplant surgeons
that
believe
naive.
That.
I think that's naive.
I understand, but there's some of the transplant surgeons that are really experienced, they believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't agree with that idea 100%. But how about doing the off pump with the balloon pump or 5-0 Impala or a little ECMO?
Well,
and I'll tell you why I say that. Mm-hmm. I agree with everything you said, but now I'm starting to get a little older and see some other cases that I think off pump is indicated. And I'll give you a good example. Patient pre-op for a liver transplant, one vessel disease.
Mm-hmm.
You know, liver patients bleed like crazy. So for me to get one vessel done off pump, I think would be a good idea for the
patient. I do too. I would support that 100%.
And see, I'm learning a lot in that transplant area. Kidney transplant, I'm gonna go one vessel bypass, off pump, and I have to tell you, one of our surgeons that you probably don't know is doing an amazing job with that.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing all these off pumps for these cases, and the question is, do you really have to have the most pretty graft? You just try not to die during the transplant.
Well, right, but you're taught, right, I understand that. And I think all of those are, now, if the patient is waiting for a transplant, a kidney transplant, they're on the transplant list, I don't really see any benefit to doing that patient off pump. I think the liver patient who is waiting for a liver or someone who is a fresh kidney transplant, because they're more vulnerable, I would advocate. I think that what I'm trying to say is not that off pump should never be done. I would never say that. But it shouldn't be done for a normal routine procedure with a patient that has an acceptable level of comorbidities that should make the operations very simple to do on it's because it's a better anastomosis. They're going to live another 20 years. You don't want them to have a repeat revascularization. That's the problem. But we have to make the pump less inflammatory, less risk of stroke when you're on pump. Not equal, I want it to be less. And I think one of the things we don't do well is understand and appreciate this glycocalyx and how much that actually influences. And I'm gonna get a little further into it because it is good point. You have good points. So, but I do agree with you. I think some patients should be done off pump. So I agree with that. I just don't think that you should do if I needed bypass surgery at my age and my condition as I am right now, I want it on pump.
Oh, me too. And I want a big incision up and down my chest so I could show it off at the pool.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, very good. So protection of Dr. Koning did this dissertation, and this thing it's massive and it's incredible. And I really recommend that anybody who has an interest in this to read this because it's very, very informative, really well done. So reduction of the sublingual microcirculation with CPB. And just so you understand, the sublingual region, and there's a ridge, is a very easily accessible area where you can visualize the microcirculation. There's very strong evidence to support that microcirculation is mirroring your actual gut perfusion, so that if this is deranged, that's deranged as well, and something to really take into consideration. So it's more global. This is a very good window into what's happening all over, in the milieu, if you will, of the body. So the glycocalyx integrity and loss of microcirculation is diminished with CPB, hemodilution, hypothermia, again, irrespective of the mean arterial pressure. Now, this is a very important slide. If you look at the part on the left, this is looking at perfused vessel density. What you want is it for it to stay equal or close to equal. So if you look at the left off pump of section A, you have a baseline, which is the white. You have the light gray, which is off pump, which is intraoperative. And then you have the dark, which is your postoperative. So you can see that the microcirculation was maintained. When you look at non-pulsatile perfusion, you see an immediate drop in perfused vessel density, which means capillaries are farther apart, so you have less ability to get oxygen and nutrient to the tissue and remove waste, becomes decreased, and it lingers even in the postoperative period. Interestingly enough, if you use pulsatile perfusion, and I have said pulsatile perfusion the way we do it doesn't work, but clearly I was wrong in this study, and you look, you can see intraoperatively there is a drop, but it returns postoperatively much faster. That's very important. If you look at the slide, the section on the right, B, this is looking at perfused boundary region. And what this is measuring is the diameter of the capillary itself. And if you look at the off pump, you can see that there is a slight decrease, but now this is inverse. You don't want this to be higher. You want it to be lower or equal. So for some reason, it ended up as being lower, which means that the diameter did not get any larger. But if you look to the non-pulsatile and the pulsatile perfusion, both intraoperatively and postoperatively, the actual diameter or the boundary from edge to edge got bigger. What that means is something was lost. What was lost? What was lost was the glycocalyx. That's what the issue is. So not only do you lose capillary surface area, you lose the glycocalyx, making your capillary larger, but of course, invasion of white blood cells, leaking of fluid, et cetera, et cetera. And if you look on the left, you see what would be normal. So you see on the top part, you have the cross section, you have the looking at it through the diameter, and then on the bottom, you have the cross section of it. You see the glycocalyx, you see the endothelial cells. If you look to the right, you can see how that has disappeared. And this can be caused, this one here, interestingly enough, was aortic surgery, ascending aortic surgery. And the cause of this, if you look at the conclusions, this study provides the first evidence in humans for shedding of the endothelial glycocalyx during ischemia and reperfusion procedures. So this was actually a circulatory arrest case. And you can see that just that alone. So what I suspect is, well, let's do this first. Have I been wrong? Graft patency long-term is improved with CPB. Major morbidity and mortality is equal or superior with CPB. However, short-term microcirculatory changes and shedding of the glycocalyx have been visualized and reported. However, the clinical significance of this is yet to be determined. And I think that's a very important point that you have to consider in this. So can we improve on CPB-associated morbidities, reducing the hemodilution? I contend that when you go on bypass and you open that venous line and you empty the heart and the venous capacitance system, and you start the pump forward, and you have all of that crystalloid going through, that has a deleterious effect. That shift, that change, especially in viscosity, I believe can wash out the glycocalyx and have a problem. And I'm going to show you something to validate that. We need to reduce inflammation, or the hemodilution. We need to attenuate inflammation process, improve pulsatility. So pulsatility does work. I've argued for years it didn't. It didn't make any difference because normally the pump can't really create a physiologic pulse. But, you know, and then look at all the total artificial hearts that are done now. They're all a continuous flow pumps. Absolutely. So why do we have continuous flow pumps if you need a pulse? People are living with a continuous flow forever. So there's probably some level of adaptability that happens in the long term. That's what I assume.
Well, I'm curious about one thing about the pump. So I'm going to ask two controversial questions. Are you advocating wrapping for every case?
No, I don't believe in wrapping at all. I think that has its own set of problems. But what I am advocating for is mixing. I think wrap is ridiculous. It's a silly thing to do. Exactly. I think it's dangerous.
Associated with renal failure, high level of renal failure. And that's what I believe. But another thing
you think it causes renal failure?
Yes.
I agree with you. We agree on that. But a lot of my perfusion colleagues out there will argue with us back in, they'll argue to the end of the year. In fact, Rodell, if he was here, would be arguing until he was blue in the face.
I'm ready to take him on because I'll tell you, I believe wrap causes renal failure. And then the other question is, do you remember back in the old days when you used to prime with blood, would you want to bring those days back?
We may have to. I think we really need to study this. I don't think we know enough is what our problem is. I don't think we really know. We think we do, but we used to think bubble oxygenators were the best thing since sliced bread. It'll never get any better than this.
And I'm going to ask you another controversy. Today's controversy day.
What is a bubble oxygenator?
No. See, you really want me to start with you. Can I get a drone here, please? What hemoglobin level are you comfortable with on pump?
It depends on the patient. I don't think there is a magic number. I think if it's a 28-year-old young female mitral valve repair, and she were to drop to 19 or 20 or even 18 and tolerated it fine, I'd leave it alone.
He meant hematocrit.
Yeah, hematocrit. If she's, well, let's say 6 hemoglobin. If it's a 74-year-old grandmom with a depressed LV already, and we do whatever operation, CABG or whatever we're going to do on her, I'd rather she had a crit of 30 or a hemoglobin of 10 coming off pump.
On pump or coming off?
Coming off.
No, I mean on pump, like on the middle of the case.
Well, I think it depends on, it's all driven by DO2. Am I flowing? Can I deliver enough oxygen to this patient? Not am I flowing enough, because you could flow 10 liters a minute, but if your hemoglobin's 1, it doesn't make any difference. I think that another thing that we don't measure routinely, which we should, is DO2. I think that's really the magic formula. If we can keep that at least above 600 milliliters per minute, then I would say you're pretty safe, especially if you have a little hypothermia. You could probably go even down to 500. But I think when you're warm, you really want to make sure that that's 700, 750 is probably a good number for that. But we don't measure it routinely. We just measure flow and don't consider the hemoglobin is low because the surgeons don't want to be dinged for giving too many transfusions. Because if they give the transfusion, they get dinged on their blood reduction program. And it's all just, you know, and blood, you know, is known to have ill effects. And I certainly recognize that. But the question is, which is worse? Lack of adequate oxygen carrying capacity or the risk of blood transfusions? I don't have the answer to that. But what you can do going on pump is you can mix. In the old days, that's what we used to do because we had so much fluid for hemodilution. So to avoid the patient having this minute worth of flow of nothing but crystalloid while you're trying to get the blood to come through the whole system because it was so big. We would take a little, add a little, take a little, add a little, just very little bit until we mixed everything. And then we would go on bypass. So there wasn't this rush of nothing but crystalloid going into the patient. And it seemed to work really well. You didn't have as many episodes of profound hypotension immediately upon initiating bypass, which I see quite frequently.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So with all of that said, I have caused more questions than I have answers. And we'll open it up to any discussion and criticisms and thoughts. You can open the phone line too if you want. Anybody calls, free trip with Dr. Samir and his lovely wife to Egypt to see the pyramids and a perfweb.us cup.
Wow, that's a bonus.
And look at this, I have this cup and what's he using? He's not even using our cups for his coffee.
Because he didn't want to give me one. He was just stingy with me, it hurts.
So any questions or comments?
No, I think, to be honest with you, like you said, if I wanted to have surgery, I would have on pump.
You would have on pump?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I would, too. Clinton, what would you do? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
One thing I would say, I wouldn't mind my hemoglobin above 8.
8?
I want 8 would be the maximum hemoglobin.
Maximum or minimum?
Maximum.
So you're okay with a hemoglobin of 7?
Absolutely. I'm a big believer in viscosity. I think viscosity is very deleterious. So I think 8, I'm very happy with 8.
Really?
Yes.
See, I feel the other way.
Only give me 8, I'm good.
Okay, I feel the other way. I think these older, fragile patients, whether male or female, that have a lot of comorbidities, a lot of other organ dysfunction, underlying renal insufficiency, pulmonary problems, notwithstanding the risk of transfusions, I just feel like they do better drier, and I feel they do better with a higher hemoglobin. At least that's been my experience. I don't have any proof.
I'm a hemoglobin of 8. I'll be happy with viscosity. You have to remember, renal failure patients are walking around in the world with a hemoglobin of 7, most of them.
True.
That's how they're walking around in the world.
True. I mean, but they don't have any kidneys.
If the nurses call me and tell me, oh, patient has a hemoglobin of 7, renal failure, I would say maybe give one unit on dialysis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really believe in viscosity and microemboli, so I'm very concerned about that. And that's why I worry about high hemoglobin.
So let me ask you this. If you, all things considered, how much of it is a number versus how much of it is how the patient looks clinically, whether it be their acid-base status, their heart rate, their respiratory rate, all these various things, how they look.
How they look is the most important thing, but sometimes you don't have time, Joe. Sometimes you have to make a split-second decision.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, with split-second, I will hover around 8. But if you have time, how it look, and you can get lactates, and you can look at SVO2 and look at all that, I'm happy to take that time. But if I have to make a split second, it's 8.
Okay. I want 10. Well, not me, because I'm pretty healthy.
For you, we're going to get you a couple of more units.
Right now, I don't need any. Okay, so, Clinton, do you want transfusions or what do you want?
I want the pump.
You want the pump?
Yeah.
See that? We've solved all the world's problems.
Well, because Clinton is an amazing engineer, so he knows more than us about the
exactly
flow
exactly.
and all that.